This is Phil Pritchett. Welcome to the P2 Podcast.
There's never been a better time than right now to be a musician.
Jimmy hit Austin.
My name's Phil, and I just want to play rock and roll, man.
Tougher than the rest. They say the life we lead ain't good enough. Our load is heavy and our hands are rough. Possession is a funny thing indeed. Get what you want and never what you need. That might be true enough for all the rest. You and me, baby.
Fans, Romans, countrymen, lend me your ears. It is Phil Pritchett here on the P2 Podcast, coming to you from Trinidad World Recording Studios, my studio here in beautiful Fort Worth, Texas. It is cold outside. A great day for just sitting around, drinking coffee, doing what we do every week here. RadioFreeTexas.org and PhilPritchett.com, broadcasting to all of you music fans out there worldwide who tune in to find that guiding light, that light on the shore in the fog as you try to navigate these chaotic musical seas, sifting through friend requests on Facebook and MySpace and wandering into your favorite record store only to find out that the CD, the album is dead. Where do we go? Where do we look for that guiding light, for some perspective on where we are in these times? That's why we're doing the P2 Podcast, of course. Well, folks, it's my distinct pleasure here to welcome a special guest. Here on the show, you all know him. Everyone knows him. Pat Green is here.
And after all the lead-up, I'm not that great after all.
Is that intro? How was that?
That was huge.
It had to be pretty big.
It was bigger than me.
You and I have known each other
I'm
a lot of years.
Too. Since I got started, yeah.
I'll have to check the register on who's been on the show. I think you're the first guy on the show who has ever sold out the Astrodome.
I'll have to check the record,
because we have had a lot of songwriters in here who play around town, and I'm just saying, you know what, I think. Now, let me check, when was he on? But Pat and I, I meet Pat? I was trying to, this first segment here is kind of give folks a little background on a... And you know what? I dare say our history maybe is somewhat of a looking glass into like where we came from.
Yeah, absolutely.
The last 10 years, it's been a chaotic times.
No doubt.
You and I got going about the same time. I was playing at Scruffy Murphy's in Waco. And,
about 1998, 1999.
98, 99. Back when it was still even cool to like even have a CD. Like some guys still had tapes.
Oh, my God, yeah.
You know?
And we guarded them like our first, when we had this CD.
Oh yes, you couldn't put your fingerprints on it.
Don't touch that. Let me touch that. I got
touch it on the edges. Touch it on the edges. You want to burn two CDs, reproduce with this CD, and then just don't even touch that one. Don't even look at that one.
Yeah, so, I still have all those master tapes when we were still we started recording digitally about.
Have y'all done all your records digitally, all the recent ones?
The last four or five. Yeah. Just because, honestly, and I've given it every bit of my effort. I can't hear the difference between digital
analog and the
analog taping is...
Lloyd Maines didn't have y'all cutting the 2-inch tape?
No, Lloyd did. Our first six records with Lloyd were all to tape.
Yeah.
And then dumped into dumped into Nuendo, which a budding program back then, or Pro Tools, and then we kind of, fixed
it. Do all your mixing digitally and automated and everything. Dude, that's great, man. Did y'all do all your records at Cedar Creek?
We did.
I remember coming to visit you down there for one of them. I can't remember which one it was.
We did the first two records at Caldwell Studios in Lubbock.
As far as
just the tracking. And then we'd go down to Austin at Cedar Creek and do the overdubbing.
Right.
And we put all the extra guitars. And, you know, because Austin was such a hub, we could get Dave Grissom to come over for a day and put down a guitar part. Just whoever you want can come by. Glenn Fuganaga would drop in and throw a bass line on it's just ridiculous people.
Wandering around.
Doing nothing today. You want to make $500? Come play on a Pat Green record.
It's like it's like the great Spencer Starnes said, who's a producer down there. He was with Sip at the Wheel forever. I was helping a guy produce a record down there. Just a starting out guy. And he said, hey, man, we got to get the studio ready for Stephen Bruton and these guys to come and do their parts. And I was mortified. I was making records. I'm like, man, Stephen Bruton's going to play on this? You got to be kidding me, man. Spencer, it was the last free.
Charlie Sexton and Stephen Bruton are coming over there. They're just going to have some coffee and talk on the tape. We'll sell it for $1 million.
That's right. Starnes just looks at me and goes, hey, man, he's a musician. I'm like, what does that mean? He's like, if you pay him, he's going to show up, you know, no matter what he's playing on. True enough, they showed up with their amp right on time, you know.
It's true.
It is
true. You know, I mean,
it's their trade, after all.
Why would you not? Yeah, I mean, you know, I always take the gig. Mm-hmm. You know, my motto in my life since I started making music has always been, you can't outwork me.
Yeah, right.
And if
that
is my attitude, then I figure, you know, I might take some dumpy, crappy gigs.
But right.
The majority of the gigs, if they're serious and are paying me what I want to get out of the gig,
sure,
then they're going to do their part by promoting the show.
That's
and
right.
You know, making the stage right, and you know, so yeah, I take it seriously, and I think most people who book, you know, bands our size do so as well.
That's right. Well, man, we recently ran into each other playing the Flatland Jam up in Illinois.
Yeah.
Hadn't played a show out of state together anywhere, I guess.
Yeah, that was our first.
That's been a lot of years. A few years since I'd seen you, ran into you and seen you guys play.
It was a cold night.
It was.
A cold, rainy night, and we were out there playing. I was like, wow.
Yeah, it was.
I can't believe there were so many people.
Well, they got hit with tons of rain, but there's a lot of. Man, it's amazing how Texas artists and guys from down here are well known up there. Y'all probably play Joe's and do real well. We've been up there and played a few times.
Absolutely.
And it's amazing that there's those pockets. I mean, all over the country. Is there somewhere y'all do particularly well all over the country over the years? You seem like, man, we just got a real strong.
You know, there's probably 15 or 20 markets out there that we do
real well.
Really well.
And, what are some of them?
Denver, Chicago, New York. New York is great. Wow. Washington, D.C., Norfolk, Virginia, Atlanta.
Where do you not do as well? You think you would do well? You're just like,
I thought we'd do well in the Midwest better. I thought we'd do, you know, well in Ohio, but we've never really performed there.
Yeah.
Done shows, but the shows really haven't done that well. You know, I'm not really surprised that we don't kill it in like Idaho.
Yeah.
Who's going to play our records up there? But that's Seattle's great to us. We've always had great
West
shows.
West Coast. You play California.
LA's really strong. San Diego.
I heard that can be tough sledding out there for the tour.
You know, it just
depends. Expensive gas, no smoking. Traffic. Yeah, no, is that not right?
Yeah, I don't get that though.
No?
I don't. You know, I think you have to be so careful on how you do. California, how you play California. You know, you kind of have to treat it as more than one state. There's, you know, northern half and southern half. Northern California is very
almost
different.
Like different countries. Almost.
Yeah, it's hugely different.
Yeah.
And, well, it's like North Texas and South Texas, to be honest. I mean, you know, there's stuff you can get away with up here where we live and that you know, south of San Antonio, you're just not going to get away with it. So, you know, whatever. But anyway, back to how we met, was, you know, like you said, at Scruffy's, and then...
I remember you handed me that Dance Hall Dreamer CD.
Because
I'm just like, oh, God, some other guy with an album.
Another guy with a record.
But it was, you know what? We said it was a shrink-wrapped CD, so I did take it. See, I was like, at least it's not a tape, you know? He's made a record. He spent some money on the artwork. It looks pretty good.
It's a picture of me and my dog.
Well, shortly after that, I think the first show we played together was, you were still... Or at least playing out in Lubbock. I don't know if you're still in school out there or not.
Probably so.
Probably.
I don't know.
How long were you out there?
You know, they say, when did you go to school? I say the 90s.
Yeah, right. The 90s. I was there all of the 90s. So we went out and played the old, not the Depot, but the other Stubbs Barbecue. Yeah. Now, that was a great room. Yeah, I can't believe they've never gotten that thing rolling again.
Yeah, just honestly, it's Bash Rip Rocks now.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is the old Bash Rip Rocks is where I did my first gig ever. Me and Corey Morrow did our first gigs
ever. Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
Just sitting on the stool.
Sitting on the stool.
Swapping songs.
With the music stand, singing Jerry Jeff Walker songs.
Just a good old boy. Hey!
Pissing in the wind. Yeah.
That I remember going out to open for Pat, and I had some, somewhat professional, quote unquote. I was living in Austin and had a couple guys who were used to playing on 6th Street, and used to, we were just playing for nobody and all this kind of, and playing a lot for pros. Like, man, we're going out there. We're gonna play a gig.
Yeah, but we were highly critical.
We're
gonna
play a gig in Lubbock. They're like, Lubbock, really? Man, so we hit the road. We're going to go. I think we played two nights in a row.
Yeah, that was the standard.
Did you play Friday and Saturday night?
Yeah, if you were the weekend gig, you usually played two nights there.
Yeah. So I said, man, we're open for this guy, Pat, man. I don't know anything about him. He's got a CD. That's all I know. And, man, of course, you guys had your deal going out. They had a big group of friends, a big following. It was a big happiness. Man, we walk into this scene, man, of just...
Yeah, it was my friends paying to hang out
with me. Yeah, that's right.
It's really kind of sad.
Pat in the back room just counting their money. But we opened the show and it just had a ball, man. Went to the after parties at various.
Yeah, did y'all sleep in the room upstairs? Did y'all sleep in the apartment?
Yes, we did. Two nights
in a row. I was
always
afraid of the apartment at Stubbs, man.
The carpet up there was just a roadmap of encrusted musician DNA.
Yeah, it was just really disgusting place.
But it was free,
an undefinable smell, but it was free. Yeah,
and everybody stayed there. I mean, they still had those big, Ely and Ian Moore and
I know.
Bands playing there.
Me,
you know?
I've even stayed there once we moved away. When I moved to Austin, I came back to play Stubbs, and we stayed there once.
Yeah, yeah.
Man, there was no shower curtains.
No shower curtain. Maybe no hot water.
Here's your toilet.
Yeah, and we ate, because they serve barbecue. I mean, Stubbs barbecue.
Yeah, great barbecue.
Good food. So Lubbock, Texas, man. So, and then I remember playing with you at, I guess it must have been one of those first Waco Salsa Festival.
Salsa Margarita downtown. Festival. Yeah, and then you came over to my house that night. We stayed up all night drinking. And the night ended with us in the, chipping golf balls from the front yard to the backyard with a wedge.
And then we went out and played golf at 6 in the morning.
Yeah.
You remember that?
Yeah, we went to Lake Waco Country Club, which is like, $8 a year for membership.
Yeah. And, who were you living in that house with, though?
I lived with
that was a nice house.
Jeff Griffin. It was our rent house. It was, we always called him Beaner.
Beaner, yeah.
Yeah, and so that's his still.
Is he still, he's still working the business?
He's working for Reckless Kelly. He's
I saw him a couple days ago. Just kind of, he said, hey, Phil, and walked by, and I said, man, I hadn't seen him probably in 8 years. I go, man, that's Beaner. I didn't know he was still playing with Reckless.
He was my pootie for many years.
Is that right? Yeah, out there on the road. Got all those guys, Greg Henry. Of course, you really still got your same band together, your same core
guys. We do have the same guys, yeah.
Michael Tarabe on bass.
Yeah, well, he was the first, when I was out in Lubbock.
He was the first guy I met of your band.
Yeah, he's still there. I went, when I wanted to start a band.
Did he go to Tech, or was he at the music school?
No,
out there?
he went to South Plains, which is out in Levelland, which is just a few miles away from Lubbock.
Big music school, engineering academy.
Real famous music school. Yeah. I mean, it's not Juilliard, but it's close.
Sure.
But at any rate,
just dustier.
So I called one of their big music professors out there, and I said, hey, I'm about to put together a band. I need a bass player, and I've got a drummer.
That's right.
Quote unquote.
Who was your drummer?
Jason Davis, who was just a buddy of mine with a drum kit.
Right.
I don't know if he was a drummer as much as he just had a drum kit.
He just loved to hit the drums. That's all we know.
He was cool, man. It didn't matter at that time. So Michael would come out, and he was a really great musician even then, still to this day. I think he's one of the best bass players in all of music.
Oh, yeah.
But
I got to play several gigs with him. He subbed a lot of gigs when I was living in Austin. In fact, he kind of lived at my house one summer.
Yeah. Lucky guy, you.
He was working.
Never a quiet moment.
Something. Never a quiet moment with Tarabe. Wow. I remember Tarabe. He'd been in your band and had gotten a bit accustomed to the professional musician life. So he played some gigs with me, and he always took it upon himself to bring me up to speed on all the proper ways.
On how to do it.
How to handle him on the road, you know.
Well, when he was
He's like, you know, man, this is my first, you know, I'd be playing for Union Scale. I mean, you know, I'm just taking this gig because I know you. Plus, we'd have food backstage. Plus, I'm required to have one bed with a radius of 20 feet. And I'm just kind of like, wait, what do you think this is, man? Get in the van and shut up.
But he was always, got that too. He was married to the Dixie Chicks for a while.
He was married to Natalie Maines.
To Lloyd's daughter, who's the lead singer of the Chicks. And, man, whenever that happened, he was in my... And we were traveling in the van.
Yeah, you know.
He was like, you know, when we check into hotels, he was like, we got to get assumed names. All the Dixie Chicks have assumed names when they check into the hotels. I'm like, dude, not only do they not know where we're staying, if they did know, they wouldn't care enough
to call.
If they
knocked on my door, I'd be flattered.
I'd be like, come on in. Would you like me to play a song for you? Perhaps an autograph?
Yeah, but Terrible, he was well versed in the ways of how things are supposed to run on the road. But just a funny guy, man, and just so much fun to have around. And man, still with you this day. It's good to see all those guys. Brendan
I guess once Jason he wasn't gonna be musician all his life. That wasn't in the cards for him.
He just threw it all away to be a lawyer or something.
So no, I think he's a pharmaceuticals rep.
Oh, okay.
He does really well.
Good deal.
But then we got Justin.
Yeah.
Well, actually, second we got Brendan.
Yeah, right.
And then Brendan brought in Justin and Brett.
Right, right.
And then everything else kind of fell bit by bit down the road. We went down the road.
And there they all are to this day.
Most of them have been in the band for 13, 14 years.
Yeah, wow. Yeah. That's a long time.
Yeah,
man.
Long time to know somebody.
It is.
You know, you kind of get the new wears off after about 8 months.
Yeah. And you feel like...
And then you're like, come on.
After you share, you know, rooms with these guys and small vehicles.
Tour buses.
Yeah, you know them all too well, unfortunately. Well, man, in our next segment, we're going to catch up with what Pat's doing now. We're going to talk about somebody who's got some perspective on maybe where music is, music, Texas music, whatever you want to call it, over the last 10 years. We'll talk about that, man, where it's been, where it's going, and what we're working on now with our friend Pat Green when we come back.
Ain't nothing easy after back up the children, then I'll grab my gun. We'll hit the trail out without leaving one. And if I lose you in the dark out there, don't shed a tear, my girl, now don't despair. There's nothing man or ever do to keep me from you, 'cause I will get to you.
Fans, Romans, countrymen, lend me your ears. It is Phil Pritchard here on the P2 Podcast. Come record at the studio, 817-733-5256, or email me, phil@philpritchard.com. Book the band. We play everywhere. Live in Canada, your kid's graduating from high school, every man has his price. We go do it all the time. You'd be surprised. So call or email. We do it all. We are here with my old friend, a friend of all music people everywhere, Pat Green is here.
Now, you'd ask 5 or 10 people, you'll get one that hates me.
Yeah, is that right?
Sure.
Well, you know what? That comes with the territory, man. You've been out there playing big shows, rattling around for several years. What is there anything over the last, you got really going maybe 98, 99, 2000?
1995.
Barely in the pre-Napster era.
95 probably. Was our first record.
95 was the first record.
And then,
but man, I didn't start raising, I didn't start raising my eyebrows. I was living in Nashville in 2001, and guys were mentioning your name up there and saying, hey man, have you heard of this guy, Pat? I was like, yeah, man, I know Pat. Oh man, he's doing good. And you know, so I start hearing a lot about you elsewhere, and what is there one overriding theme you've seen in the last 10 years? Maybe not specifically pertaining to your own experiences, but just, I don't know.
Only overriding theme in the last 10 years is I keep getting older.
Yeah, don't we all?
Man, I've seen a lot of things I think that are very positive, and I think as well as some downtrending as well. I think that the obviously. Not Napster as much as iTunes coming into play has really made made a huge change in the music business that everybody is not only seeing but feeling. You know, these humongous corporations that were getting fat on when it cost, you know, 80 cents, 75 cents to make a CD, and you're selling it at, you know, $9 to the wholesalers.
17 retail or whatever.
Yeah, that means that, you know, they were basically making around $8 a record. And
right.
Now that they're only selling one song at a time, and you're making basically on a huge hit, you might make, you know, $500,000
right.
as opposed to, you know,
$50 million.
Yeah, right, the difference is, you know, off by two zeros. And so I just think these huge companies are, you know, everybody knows that they're headed for downsizing. And but that's the nature of business. You know, when horses became extremely unnecessary once the gasoline engines came along. But, you know, nobody's really worried about the horse farmer.
Yeah, anymore. That's right. Well, so, you know, you invent the wind powered or solar powered car, you know, that.
Yeah,
can keep up. Will look different.
So, but at any rate, I don't think it's a negative thing. I think that, you know, that change is a positive thing. It forces people to get leaner. I think it forces music to get more organic, in the way you sell it. And I think it's a good thing for a guy like me, because, you know, as much as I tried to get up there into the, you know, Keith Urban, George Strait kind of place, is where I had my sights set, you know, since I was 10 years old.
Sure.
Was take Texas music as big as I could make it. But at the same time, the reality was that that's very difficult to do. I mean, since I've been in the business in the last 14 years, only 15 bands or individual artists have made it to arena status.
Right.
And
God,
so,
is
I
that
mean,
right?
Yeah. So, I mean, you think about it, George Strait, Garth Brooks.
Sure.
Dixie Chicks, only for a little while.
You can name them
Keith Urban,
on a few hands.
You know, exactly. Yeah. There's less than 20. And so, you know, the chances of me getting that done was pretty slim. But,
right.
So I gave it a try anyway. But, you know, here we are on this side of it now. I was on Universal Records from 2001 till 05.
You did three records with them?
I did three with them. I did 3 days. Wave on Wave and Lucky Ones with them. Then I left there to sign. You know, I really wanted to sign with that was in New York.
Right.
And I wanted to, you know, be in a part of the Nashville system, because I feel like, you know, fighting City Hall when you're trying to get music, country music played into radio, it's worthless. You might as well just be banging your head against the wall. So I signed up with BNA, which is RCA Records, basically.
Right.
And I did two records for them, Cannonball and What I'm For, and, you know, both of those ended up going in the, you know, number two spot on the Billboard charts and sales.
Yeah.
But in reality, they didn't do as much as I wanted to, and so I left there just a few months ago.
So where does that leave you today?
Right now, I'm independent. I'm totally out of Alpha Record deal, and I don't, you know, I'm not actively pursuing one right now.
Well, this show is about nothing if not the independent guy. I think, you know, when you and I came up, there was that pie in the sky. You could look at Hootie and the Blowfish and just go, holy crap, you know, these guys sold 20 million albums. You just said, so how am I going to put kids through college with this deal or whatever you're
thinking?
Well,
the day of selling 20 million records
gone. But
that's
at least
totally
it existed
gone.
At some point.
Yeah.
And so nowadays, I mean, not even guys like you and me that are somewhat, you know, we've been around, we can go play the Firehouse and do good or whatever that may be. Man, to the young guy, you know, in this studio we're in, produce a lot of albums for guys making their first album, coming in with their uncle. He's back in the deal, man. And so, you know, and man, my, you know, it's my business, but my heart sinks a little bit. But you know, they're not spending $30,000-$40,000 albums to make an album. They're spending a few thousand dollars. And I tell them, I go, look, you know, you got to live to fight another day. And you know, the reality is, if people just download it for free off your MySpace,
that's all you did. I mean,
That's all there is. You know,
spent $12,000 to make the Here We Go record. I mean,
yeah,
it's even the Dance Hall Dreamers record.
Do you think those days are returning to some extent?
I don't think. I mean, you can make a record for whatever you want.
Yeah, that's right.
I mean, I've made $500,000 records, and I've made records for.
Yeah.
12 grand. I mean,
the
honest truth of it is that at this point in my life, I just want to go, I want to make a record with my band in a studio and be comfortable making what I want to make, and then go take it to a, you know, XYZ radio,
right,
I mean,
right.
a record label, and say, here's my project, and I'll go sell it.
Right.
And what I've been doing for the last, you know, decade that has, I think, you know, squashed my soul a little bit, but done a tremendous amount of good for my business.
Right.
Is that, you know, every day I go into the studio, there's a record exec sitting there looking over my shoulder saying, don't you think it'd be better if we did this?
Bringing this
you
guy.
Know, and it's like, you know, I get it. You know, and I always had the attitude that those were the guys that were putting millions of dollars on the line to promote me.
Right.
Then I was going to listen to their opinion. It's stupid not to. Don't.
You can't bite the hand that feeds.
Yeah. What's the old saying? Don't steal somebody's hat and then help them look for it.
Yeah, right.
You know?
That's right. Like, well, it's the same thing. Yeah.
You know, I could not.
It's a fine line to walk.
Yeah, I couldn't sit there and disregard. You know, and a lot of guys do. A lot of bands sign a record deal and then they get immediately resentful that the people that are helping them have something to say about how they put their music out. And that's just not how it works. And, you know, so I've been, you know, to the eight people that get on the internet and type, you know, whatever their mean words are about people who, you know, sign record deals or whatever. Man, that's just, I wish there was any kind of reality to it. There's just not. You cannot make it forward out of the coffee houses into the bars and from the bars to the theaters and from the theaters to the arenas without getting more and more and more airplay.
Right.
You can't do it.
Yeah. That's the whole key. I mean, it's just radio play.
I mean, there's some bands out there that, you know, our band got extremely lucky that had this groundswell that got us up to maybe getting, you know, 1,000 people out to the shows.
Right.
But once it got there, we hit a ceiling so hard that it didn't matter what we did, we could not get past it. And we'd go play because we thought, oh, we just had 1,000 people at this place in Austin last
night. Next time it'll be
we'll
this.
We'll go play the 3,000 seater and there'd be 900 people.
Well, it seems like we've talked about on with various people. It seems like, you know, back when, again, you and I are coming up, 90s or so, you look at the 12 issues of Rolling Stone that year. It's just Tom Petty, Eric Clapton, Nirvana. I mean, you were just a ubiquitous million seller to be in that position.
Yeah.
And you look at Rolling Stone today, it's, you know, Jack White, Arcade Fire, you know, whatever sort of, now Taylor Swift would be an exception, but there's there's a lot of bands on the cover of Rolling Stone and playing Saturday Night Live who come through town. And where are they playing? They're playing where you're playing, Phil, at the Granada Theater. Now they'll sell that out at a bigger ticket, but I'm just like, yeah, is that all these guys can? I mean, you know, I mean, how can we praise Wilco anymore? I mean, can they play on Letterman and Saturday Night Live and be on Rolling Stone?
Yeah.
Do they need a bigger picture? Or, you know, but there's just kind of, man, they roll into town, they play for 1,200 people. Now, in some festivals, it's a lot bigger, but I'm talking hard tickets. It's just like, you wonder if anybody after the old dinosaurs, Billy Joel and McCartney and Elton John, who we're all still competing with, by the way, once they're gone, you just wonder, man, are bands, is people still going to fill the American Airlines Center to hear music? You think they will?
I don't know. I don't really know or care. I have to say, man, I am to the point in my life and in my career where I want to do gigs that make me happy. And, you know, after, like I said, after 14 years on the road and missing my kids and going to bed lonesome you know, my kids are incredible.
Yeah.
And my wife is incredible. And to
you're a family man here in Fort Worth.
You know, I'm to the place now where it's like, man, if I feel like going and playing the Houston Rodeo and doing the big money, you know, the big monster gig, then I can do that. But if I want to go down the road and play for 2,000, 5,000 people, I'll do that. And you know, but in reality, you know, I'm with you. I see that all the time. You know, and it's hard for me to think, you know, wow, I've done some stuff, you know, we've sold out some of these enormous arenas that bands that I think are way cooler than me, you know, couldn't play in the lobby, you know.
Absolutely, like, yes, no question about it.
But so we've done some great stuff, but it really, in the long run, nobody cares, you know,
Everybody, it's kind of like when I first got going on a parallel micro level. I've talked about, you know, going to the first time we ever went to Nacogdoches when nobody really went out there.
Yeah.
But the CD.
What was that place called?
Oh, there was like the Annex.
One of our buses, when we were touring through there one time, we hit that building with our bus and
ran into it physically.
Yeah. Like took the whole awning
down. I think it's still there.
Yeah, we were there one night when it caught on fire. We played there. We've been through a lot at the Annex.
We caught on to, tapped into something where it was just hundreds and 500 people coming to when we came into town.
Yeah.
And there's that empty feeling when you put out your third album and you go out there and, oh, man, that guy, he graduated. He lives in Houston now, and you're back to playing for 100 people.
Yeah.
I imagine it'd be even see more of that. Man, we had 10,000. Now we only have 3. I mean, is it kind of the same thing to some extent?
I used to get let down by that, but that's just the nature of it. I mean, the first time I bought a James Taylor record, he was playing, and I was down in Austin.
Yeah.
I remember going to see him at Frank Irwin Center and just thinking, my God, this guy is enormous.
Yeah.
You know, and then when he put out Copperline?
I think that's right.
Or New Moonshine's the name of that record.
Right.
Has the song Copperline on it. But New Moonshine, and I didn't even go buy it, but he was touring and he was playing it like the Paramount.
Yeah.
You know? And I was like, you know, that's just natural. You know, John Denver was the hottest rock star of all time when he was at his peak. And, you know, it was like, you're going to see the same people going up as you see going down.
Yeah. And they're all out there and nobody retires. Everybody just grows old. Everyone just does it till they're 80 years old, you know?
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of where that's what I want to do. I mean, I became friends with Jerry Jeff when I was down in Austin, and I was like, man, that was, I look at him as such a hero to me because, you know, and he, you know, he's, you know, about 15, 20 years older than I am, but man, when he was really, you know, he was just done. He was like, man, I'm not going to go out there and beat my head against the wall for 100 dates a year. I bet he plays 40, 50 gigs a year, and he loves every minute of it.
Yeah.
You know, and he makes a fine living doing it.
Sure.
But, man, you know, it's...
You got to somehow get comfortable with what you need out of it. And, you
need the hero song. You need one big song.
That's
got
right.
Mr. Bojangles. I got Wave on Wave.
There you go. You're set for life.
I got the branding. Folks know who we are and what we're doing.
That's right. There is a tough point to where you do start making money playing gigs, and it's difficult. And I ran into this early on, just on a small level. You just go, hey, just because the guy down the street's going to give me $200 to come play for an hour, is that what I do, or do I not do that? I mean, because you remember a few years when you couldn't get anything, so you feel bad for maybe looking beyond that or going, man, you know, I got a good gig Saturday. I don't know. I don't want to leave the house. I don't know. I don't know when. That's a weird line to draw. I remember Jack Ingram got on me one night, just going, I can't believe you're playing by somebody's pool for $500. I'm like, man. They paid me $500. He goes, man, you can't be doing that. You can't be doing that. You know, and he was, whatever. I don't know. I
mean, he's a good businessman.
He is. Yeah,
but I agree with that sentiment, too. There are great gigs that come down the pipe that you have to say no to because, like, you know, if you did a gig in the same town, you know, last month for X, and they're offering you 30% less to do this other gig, well, then now your price in that market is the lower of the two prices, whether you like it or not.
That's right.
And so, it's...
There's a lot of strategy involved.
Well, I just think it's funny that people call it, you know, think that it's this artistic, you know, it's all about the art, yada, 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 but it's show biz. And the reason why it's the old sleight of hand, I mean, they don't want to say show business because they don't want you to think of it as something you spend your money
callous
on.
Callous. Yeah,
oh,
yeah.
God, this is not commerce. This is art, you know.
Yeah, that's right.
But it's show business. And,
that's right.
It is not, it's not just show biz. It's a way to, you know, we've been feeding 20 families,
right?
You know, between the road and the office back at the house, you know, here in town, and you know, there's no way I could do this if we weren't, you know, making money doing it.
Yeah,
I'd be making
strategic decisions on how you present
yourself. I'd be working for my dad's oil company.
Yeah, there you go.
that's all I'd be doing. You know?
Well, man, he mentioned, of course, everyone's favorite Jerry Jeff Walker.
Yeah.
Boy, my web guru, Kevin Haggard, is listening out there. The biggest Jerry Jeff fan in the world. He always gets on me when we don't talk about Jerry Jeff enough. You know me, the rock guy. I'm always talking about The Clash or something.
Which we were talking about
he
last night.
He gets pissed. Yeah, so...
You know, Joe Ely was the backing vocals Should I Stay or Should I Go?
Is that... Really?
Yeah.
Of course, he toured with him back in the day, you know, went over there to England. Oh, another Lubbock, great Lubbock guy, Joe Ely. Well, man, let's talk about... Pat went over to the esteemed vinyl rack over here. Yeah. Pulls out Riding High, Jerry Jeff Walker. Yeah. Called it, man, this is one of my greatest records of all time. One of his favorites. He knows Jerry Jeff. And, you know, let's hear some Jerry Jeff Walker stories and a little analysis on Riding High by Jerry Jeff Walker with Pat Green when we come back.
Hey, hey, everybody. This is Pat Green, and you're listening to Phil Pritchett, my buddy on the P2 podcast.
Got my eyes in a fire down in Texas. Got a toehold in Tennessee. I got my foot in the door of that California store. I'm up to my ears in weed. Don't be concerned if the song sounds familiar. Don't be concerned. It all seems the same. Just be concerned that your policies will kill you. And it's all just public domain.
Fans, Romans, countrymen, lend me your ears. It is Phil Pritchett here on the P2 podcast. Pat Green is here, Fort Worth, Texas' own Pat Green, talking about... Oh, man, music, the last 10 years, his ride through the music world, Texas and everywhere else you can imagine. Well, over there at the vinyl rack, his eyes just paused, and he just had a distant look, glazed look in his eyes. He reached for Riding High by Jerry Jeff Walker, his good friend. How many years have you known Jerry Jeff?
I've known Jerry Jeff since the 1990...
Were you already a musician, or did you go up there and just whip his ass one day after a gig?
Oh, no, I was a musician, and I'll never forget this story as long as I live, man. Actually, the first day I met him was in Lubbock at the Calf Fry, which was a big concert that went on every year. And
playing with his band or solo?
Yeah, with his band. Okay. He was opening for... it was like either Clay Walker or Tracy Lawrence.
Okay,
or something.
One of the big
blues. At that time was a big band.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's probably 5,000 or 6,000 people out at the show, and Jerry Jeff had opened. And at the time, I'd opened for Willie Nelson, and I had him sign my guitar.
Okay,
and I'd opened
yeah,
for
yeah.
some other guys, and, you know, anybody who I had opened for, they'd sign the guitar. And, well, at this particular time, I wasn't on the show, but I snuck backstage, and I was waiting in Jerry.
Now, is this out in a field somewhere?
No, this is at the Lubbock Convention Center.
Okay, yeah, okay.
This is probably 95, 96, something like that. But so I guess I'd known him for a lot longer than I thought, a couple of years more.
Yeah.
I was in there in his dressing room, and he got off stage, like hadn't even had a chance to relax or you know, whatever.
Sweating, breathing hard.
Yeah.
Here's some guy in his dressing room, his guitar.
At which point, I would have kicked this guy out immediately. I wouldn't even look at him, you know. But anyway, so I'm sitting there with my guitar out of the case, and I'm like, Jerry Jeff, will you please sign my guitar? And he goes, ugh. And he signs it, and he goes, all right. And I go, and I'm like, man, I'm sorry if I irritated you. He goes, man, you're in my dressing room. I just got off the show. I'm like, man, there's a lot of people who want your autograph. I'm a brand new musician, and this guitar means a lot to me. It's a very special guitar. And, you know, it's like, I don't know. I don't know how to tell you this, man. It's just, I kind of wanted him to be happier
about it,
you know, but it was just, I was still the intruder.
That's
you know?
Right.
And so his reply was, well, take your blankety blank special guitar and get the blank out of my dressing room. You know,
the
and
beginning of a beautiful friendship.
You know,
right
he
there.
He didn't even remember it, you know, and he will, you know, to this day, you know,
remind him, and he just goes, oh, that's not
that
true.
That never happened, you know.
Oh, but, my gosh.
It was funny. So, but at any rate.
So, did you catch up with him later on, and he didn't remember him? Was it like a different deal?
2 years later, like I think it was 97 or 99 or somewhere, I don't know when it was, a couple years later, he invited me to come play the Labor Fest
right.
down in Luckenbach.
The tables had turned by that
Well,
point.
He didn't know who I was.
Right,
you
right.
know.
But somebody got
yeah,
you
yeah,
yeah.
So, you know, but so whatever, you know, I got on the show. And then so he invited me down to his house to do in Austin to do some radio interviews.
Yeah.
And so we went around town doing radio and promoting the show. And then
just you and him in the truck driving
Yeah,
around?
Just me and
yeah?
him in the truck. And,
that's
and
great.
It was great. And we stopped off right before we went to the first studio and got a 12-pack. And we took it in there. He goes, you know, the guy was like, no drink. And
yeah,
on the
right.
air, it's like, okay.
Yeah, right, right.
This kept going.
Jerry Jeff Walker rules.
Yeah, I mean, this is like the first night I'd ever, this is before Labor Fest ever happened. This is, you know, in the promo stage of that big gig. And so, you know, by, you know, 2-3 hours later, after we've hit all these radio stops, we go to the, what was that? The Deep Eddy.
Oh, yeah.
Down in Austin, which is the, I keep saying down in Austin. I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, yeah.
It's kind
down
of embarrassing.
Yeah,
keep,
yeah.
I'm kind of embarrassed, but at any rate, so it's
a great, musician hangout bar. You
yeah,
and I have met at the Deep Eddy.
Yeah, a few times.
We lived there. Yeah.
Fantastic oh, yeah. place. Only holds about 25 people, and
right.
it's right there on Lake Austin Boulevard. And
one of which is Chris Wall and Mary Cutrafella.
Oh, my God.
A couple guys.
We've
that's a whole other episode.
We've done some other things
Go
that
ahead.
We shouldn't talk about, but. At any rate, so he walked in the door with his guitar, and me and it was at that time we picked up Bruce Robinson.
Yeah.
And so it was the three of us. We walked in there, and Jerry looked at the bartender and said, "Don't let anybody else in." And we were kind of half drunk. And then we started ordering pitchers of beer, and then he goes, "Turn off that effing jukebox." And so they unplugged the jukebox, and we get out the guitar, and we just start playing. You know, and drink
and the
until
deep, did he really lock the door?
They well, didn't the door. Lock the door, but
they just kind of didn't let anybody in.
I don't know if they let anybody else in or not, but it was cool that he said it. You know,
yeah.
like he had the power to stop people from coming in.
Right,
it was a great night for
imposing
me.
Imposing his will. That's a great night.
Yeah, and
Man.
Then
Joe's kind of passed the guitar, drank beer, and
yeah, that's
ready.
It.
Yeah.
And then you know, Joe Ely shows up, and it was all. It was just such a cool Austin thing that doesn't happen very much anymore.
Yeah,
but,
yeah.
You know, we drank till we, you know, till they said okay, we're either. I don't know if we ran them out of beer, if they just clad to clothes. And we're walking out of there, and Jerry Jeff throws me the keys to his brand new Lexus. That was right when Lexus was, you know,
the thing to
starting
have.
To happen.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it was like $90,000 car, and you know, I've got a truck, you know. And I'm like,
Pat,
Jerry Jeff, I've
wheel.
Been drinking for 9 hours.
Let me tell you what, when you tell Pat Green to take the wheel after a hard night of drinking, you've been doing some drinking,
you know,
more than likely.
I mean, it was a scary situation, but I mean, I did it.
What
I,
did Bruce do? Did he just walk? He must have just run down the street.
Bruce had a ride. Somebody, Kelly came and picked him up or something. But
honey, come get me, dear God.
Jerry
please.
Jeff drunk me. He asked Pat Green to drive.
Don't let Pat and Jerry Jeff drive me home. Get over here quick.
Yeah,
oh, that's great, man.
Great night.
That's a great night, dude.
So, yeah, I spent the night at Jerry's house on the couch. And
many a time.
Yeah, and then that night and drove home. And,
yeah.
Wow. I got in a really bad car wreck that day. The next day.
The next day?
Yeah.
That was the next day?
The next day.
And I remember.
Check it out. The next day.
I remembered hearing that.
Yeah, it was. What was it? Some kind of holiday the next day.
Now, is this when you were living at the duplex in Austin? Was you living in Austin?
No, I was living in Waco.
Okay.
I was just getting out of college.
Okay, right.
You know, still.
Before you moved to Austin?
Yeah, right before I moved
to
Austin.
Right.
I think, honestly, Jerry Jeff had a lot to do with me moving to Austin. I just, him and, you know, the fact that my wife, you know, well, she wasn't my wife then. She was my girlfriend. And she was going to move down there and start working for the Speaker of the House.
Right.
The state capitol. And I was like, man, I'm going to follow her down there.
Right, right.
So she was down there for a couple months, and I moved down, and you know, we did like Jerry Jeff and Susan Walker did. We got married in Luckenbach.
Yeah,
and,
oh yeah.
We had a lot of great times hanging out at their house, and you know, I'll never forget one night Django was over at Lipa.
Now, how old was he in these years? Still
well,
teenager.
Right when I first got to know him, he was still in high school.
Okay, right.
And but you know, as he got out of high school, several years later. They had us over for dinner, you know, which is, you know, we had a lot of dinners over there and we'd sit around and, you know, basically talk about what was wrong with everything in the world and, and how we were powerless to fix it.
That's right.
You know, and then we, you know, sit, right after that was over, Susan and Corey would, you know, Corey, my wife, would, you know, sit around and talk. Me and Jerry Jeff go in the office and play guitar and whatever.
Yeah.
And the thing I remember about that, too, is that Jerry Jeff, even during dinner, would eat dinner with a guitar in his lap.
And is that right?
He was always walking around the house with his guitar on his shoulder and just always playing. I, It's one of, he's just right? one of those guys never puts the guitar down. But at any rate, so we were sitting there, and Django was home from LIPPA, which is the Liverpool School for the Performing Arts, which is Paul McCartney's school.
Oh, right, right.
Over
in the UK. going to school abroad.
Abroad, yeah. He had gotten this assignment to write a song about, I don't know what it was, either where you're from or just an experience, right, or whatever. So he wrote this song called Texas on My Mind.
Yeah.
And he got like a D on the project, like a terrible grade.
I wonder how many of those songs written for that project were ever recorded, much less beloved by an entire state.
Oh, my God, you know.
And that's great.
So that night, Django was kind of embarrassed to play the song because, you know, whatever. I don't know if he was upset.
Did he have it finished or do you have
to get it? Yeah, no, it was a demo. Yeah, it was a full-on demo. Yeah, yeah. And you know, Jerry just, no, I'm going to play it. And Django's like, don't play it. So, he did it. And I was like, man, I will put that on my next record. I swear I will do it. And the next record was a live album.
Yeah, yeah,
it
that's
was
right.
Live from Green Hall.
Right.
And Green Hall and Shadow Canyon Dance Hall in College Station.
Right.
Recorded two nights. But that song, you know, we can't if we don't play it in the night, people get upset with us now. And he got a D.
Oh, is it really? Is that still have that kind of prominence in your set to this day?
Every night, and you know, the crowd sings every word.
Yeah,
it's
a
huge song.
Do you remember we were on the bill at the Shadow Canyon? I don't know if you recorded that night. But we played.
I
don't know if there's another band or not. I don't think there was.
I don't know. I don't think so. I would doubt it.
You had the big RV back there.
Oh, and, yeah. That was our tour bus.
Yeah, and we...
and it had a slide.
I'd never been inside the Shadow Canyon.
That was back when we actually still pooped in our tour bus.
Before you knew the rule.
Yeah, you did. No rule. No pooping. No pooping.
Well, that was, when I was living in Nashville, I didn't know bus etiquette like that. So we were on Charlie Robinson's bus. My old drummer...
That's okay. I'm glad you pooped on Charlie Robinson's
bus. Well, we were sitting... My old drummer played for Charlie, so we were on the bus, and someone makes the comment that I like this bus better because the bathroom's bigger. There's a bunch of guys, a bunch of veterans. You know, I was just this greenhorn guy, so I just kind of make a joke, trying to be funny. I kind of go, "Yeah, man, you need a little room in there when you got the paper in the morning." And all of a sudden, everybody just kind of looks at me, and just one by one, they get up and just kind of disgustedly walk out of the room. I'm just like, "What?" And my drummer friend's just like, "Dude, you do not do that on the bus." I'm like, "Well, what are you talking about?" They're like, "Dude, that's the rule. That's the only rule." I'm just like, okay. And from
there's
then
not
on,
10 commandments in music.
And from then on,
one commandment.
From then on, I've yet to find one person. We'd lease a bus for a show or something. I'd stand up in front of it everywhere. I said, "All right, does everybody know the rule?" Everybody shrugs and just said, "Yeah, man, there's no pooping on the bus." I'm just like, So I haven't found one guy. I was the last guy to know.
Well, we bought a new bus, like right when things started really changing in my life, and music, you know, the music started getting played on the radio, and the Grammys and all that stuff. I was like, man, it's time to get my own bus. And
so you buy your own bus? Do you always lease them?
I've always bought my bus.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah. We had the red bus, which was kind of the one, your first tour bus, and we owned that, and then it burned up in front of Ted Turner's high school in Knoxville one day.
There's another episode.
Yeah.
God, I hope you can come back and finish some of these.
Well, let's just say the fire department was pulling out some suspicious articles.
You guys ran for the hills.
But so anyway, but so that bus went away, and then we bought the bus that we're on now. And then when, you know, Wave on Wave hit, I bought this other bus, and my grandmother did not know the rule.
Oh, no.
So, like, the first
the
week
number one
I
rule.
Ever owned it, I pull up in front of my mom's house, and, you know, Meemaw is there, and, you know, pulls out the deuce on me.
Oh, you know? No. Oh, the only rule.
Yeah.
The only rule.
Yeah.
And Phil didn't know it at one point.
Neither did me, Mom.
It's something you learned.
She didn't know.
So, man, back to Jerry Jeff. Poor old Jerry Jeff. He's tuning in to hear about the influence his riding high had on Pat. When did you hear this? Was this...
Did we all
learn Viva Terlingua first? Was that the first thing
Definitely.
We all heard? That was everything.
That was the first one I heard. But
yeah,
then
me
this
too.
Was second, right after. Right. For me, as far as what I found. But I think what I learned most about Jerry Jeff is... like we were talking about earlier, how to treat it like a business.
Yeah.
And how to be smart about it, and how to be, because he went through these just incredibly rambunctious, crazy times.
Swings of fortune and,
throwing TVs out the window and all that,
God bless him.
He got to do that, but he you know, kind of steered me away from all that and, down the right path. And Susan too. Susan is, you know, a genius when it comes to, you know, how to make the most out of a night. If you're going to spend the night away from your house, you know, get something for it. And so, you know, I really appreciated that and how to. I learned a whole lot just hanging around with them.
Well, he was one of he was a rare guy that you know, he was kind of an independent. He was just a cottage industry music business.
Yeah.
Before you had, like, it seemed like you had a lot of them. Now, everybody's kind of like doing their own, you know, just kind of the economy or the changing music times. But Jerry Jeff, even in the 90s and early 90s was still like that, putting out his own records.
Well, but I mean, he was on big record labels forever.
Oh, yeah, man, back in the 70s and 80s.
I mean, let's see here. I'm trying to figure out what this one was, but.
He was MCA. I mean, he did.
Yeah, he was definitely on MCA. Yeah. But,
Tried and True, that was something he had in the early 90s.
He did like 10 records in 1 year, I want to say.
Oh, did he really?
Crazy like that. I mean, just so he could fulfill his contract, I think, you know.
Yeah.
But yeah, he put out a ton of those records, and I think that's when he, you know, kind of felt like some of his music was kind of suffering through being on a record label. And I felt that way too.
Sure.
And, you know, it really was the Live at Green Hall album that he did.
Right.
I'm not sure exactly what year. When I think he found out, man, he, you know, I'm sorry, that's my phone.
Oh, that's all right.
That not only he still had it, but he was great at it. And, you know, the thing about him is that he's always been, is a great showman. And I loved doing shows with Jerry Jeff because it was kind
of... You learn a lot watching him.
It was this unspoken competition.
Yeah.
It was and he didn't mind telling you about it. And he was, you know, you'd walk off stage and he'd be like, yeah, come on.
Yeah.
You know, just
pretty good.
That.
Just wait. Yeah.
You know,
right.
Yeah, hey, you did a great job, but just stick around.
Right.
That was always great to try to kind of a friendly competition with him on the stage. Was fun. We've done humongous shows after we got to be, you know, friends, and after my life started going, and, you know, and his career was definitely at the time just booming.
Yeah.
You know, we
could
fill up anything.
Right,
you know?
Right.
It didn't matter where you put us, the two of us were going to put on a show for thousands and thousands and thousands of people, and it was going to be all you could do to not have to go pee during the show.
That's right.
You know?
That's right, man. Jerry Jeff Walker, man. Oh, all those folks out there would love to hear him just getting more talking here. I mean, how can you have a Texas music show without Jerry Jeff coming up every few episodes?
I don't know.
Or so it seems. You just can't do it.
He's my favorite. So.
Yeah. How old is he now, JJ? I have no idea.
I think he's 40.
43? The cover of Riding High, about the same age as he is there.
Yeah, he's aged a bit.
Well, man, what a great episode, man. Boy, talk about some stories, some gold from the vault, from the annals of recent Texas music history. Pat Green has been here, Fort Worth's own. Here talking about sharing stories over the last 10 years, talking about what he's doing now. We can't wish him any more than great luck here in the very near future. It's great to catch up with you again. Thanks for coming in today on the podcast.
Right on.
All right.
Thanks for having me, Phil.
You bet, man. Well, that wraps it up for this edition of the podcast. Email me, phil@philpritchard.com, or call me 817-733-5256. It's like old Jerry Jeff. It's a cottage industry, man. Let us know what we can do, and we will be out there.
How'd you like to mow my yard?
That's right. That'll cost you. I'll play a show as well after mowing the yard. We'll see you next week on the podcast. Be good to each other out there.
People are saying that time takes care of people like me.